You just brought our conversation back to life, death, sci-fi.
Yeah, I see we've clicked record. I know, it all comes back. I'm here with a man who, I want to say, wouldn't stray off the path, but you would stray off the path to save someone or break from the path for the right moral reasons. We'd have to examine what the path is, right?
What the path is? If it's raining donuts, I think I would step off the path.
Yeah, exactly. We're here to discuss Ray Bradbury's A Sound of Thunder.
Yes.
Ray Bradbury, all-time favorite for me. And people ask me, who's your favorite? I always hate this question about favorites because I feel like it makes you form judgments immediately.
There's so many favorites.
Yeah. And how do you narrow that? And there's some judgment there that comes with favorites. But when people ask me that question, Ray Bradbury is absolutely the name that comes to mind. His books, his short stories come to mind. He comes to mind when it comes to authors. Yeah.
Here at Life, Death, Sci-Fi, Ray Bradbury, I think, is the only one. Oh, I know he's the only one that is in each season. This is our third season.
That's right. That's true. Yeah. Will we get any other overlap? I'd say it's unlikely, although I might make a suggestion later that we'll see. Maybe gets us another one. It would be a pretty interesting one, too, because I think not a favorite, but one that we keep reading. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to wait, but I'm
curious. Yeah, I'm going to leave that. That'll be something, we'll come back to.
I'm curious. Yeah, I think Ray Bradbury, reading this story again, Sound of Thunder, he might be a time traveler. He certainly is a genius when it comes to writing these kinds of stories. He wrote about the chaos theory before the chaos theory was invented. This story is written in 1952, and the chaos theory came about in 1960. And on top of that, if you use some of the tools to prove the chaos theory, the data, the results, looks like a butterfly.
Oh, wow. I didn't know
that. Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy.
That is crazy. Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. We'll have to link to that in the show.
I will put the link for that because when it happens, when that data is being drawn in front of you using the chaos theory, you don't see it at first. You just think, okay, this is, and then even the guy who was doing the narration says, and it looks like a butterfly.
Huh. That's fascinating. Yeah, just the phrasing itself, right, with the butterfly and the butterfly effect. Pretty amazing that it comes from this short story.
Yes.
The idea of this butterfly. And so later people talk about, I think, the flapping of wings and an insect. And I think the idea that it was this, butterfly. That's obviously a spoiler. I guess we should say there will be spoilers in life.
In life, death, sci-fi.
You can expect that. You hope you've read it. We assume you've read it. Like us. Yeah.
Yeah. Many times.
So many times.
So,
well, yeah.
Okay. From this little effect, you get big things. When people talk about this, you see it in the literatures. They talk about the guy who invented penicillin by mistake, and that was used to save so many people in the war. So that effect, that little invention, gave rise to saving thousands and thousands of lives. And then it also saved Churchill. And if Churchill hadn't been around, then he wouldn't have given those dramatic speeches to save Europe and England. And then the invasion would have happened. Hundreds and thousands of lives have been saved, and maybe a direction the world would not want to go. So you can take little things like those examples and blow them up, and it's very impressive. You think, oh, what does that have to do with me? If I make a little change big changes happened down the way. Yeah, I think yes and no. It's also been explained that not every little change makes those super big changes. Think of the game Jenga. You pull out the little logs in there, and some of the logs won't cause any effect. And maybe one will knock it all down.
Yeah, true. Although that one that you pull may influence the person who pulls the next one, and that may or may not have a larger effect, right? Yeah. We should set this up a little bit, maybe the quick sort of plot summary or the premise. So the premise here with The Sound of Thunder is there's an organization. We're in 2055, I think, and there's an organization that, which is 100 years after the time he was writing about it, which is interesting. He's writing this in the 50s, and we can maybe come back to the touch on maybe a little bit of that context and how that may have influenced him. It's 2055, and there's a corporation, Safari Inc. Is that right?
I think so. Time something Inc. like that.
Time Inc. And so Time Inc. has these safaris, time safaris, and they take people back in time. I guess we don't know, which is interesting, that they don't go to the future, but they go back in time. And it seems like that would be a lot seemingly safer, although there's obviously a future beyond wherever you landed in the future that you'd be influencing. Sorry, I'm not sidetracking here. Anyway.
A trickier read.
Yeah, they go, at least you wouldn't know, so you wouldn't feel influencing people you don't know. But anyway, they go back in time, and there's somebody from the group. I think it's this Les Perrance, one of the characters who goes back, will go back first, set this up as Hag, a dinosaur, in a way that he finds a dinosaur that is about to die anyway. And in this case, I think a tree is about to fall on it and kill it. And it's because
I want to just jump in there. This guy is a great scout. He goes out, he finds this dinosaur that's about to die. Okay, but how does he do that? He's walking around or this path?
Well,
it floats up.
Yeah, we got to come back.
All right.
There's some plot holes or real questions here, I think, that don't quite always work. And I think that we found that's almost always the case with time travel. So they go, anyway, it's set up in a way that they're supposedly they can kill a dinosaur, hunt this big game, and then return. And they walk through a path that's raised in the jungle that's all set up, and they don't touch anything. And then they can come back to the present, having killed this game, and return to life as normal.
Yeah. They get a picture with their gone dinosaur, and they come back. But the thing is, from the very beginning, there's this guy, Travis, who is mean, but he is the rule giver. He gives all these rules about how you can't do this, you can't do that, because you don't want to change anything in the present where we're from. And you better watch out.
We know that the present they leave from, there's just been an election, and can't remember the guy's name. Keith is the name. I don't know, last name. And he's won. He was elected. And they're really glad that this, is it Deutscher?
Yeah.
Interesting choice, but this sort of German name that I would assume that's purposeful, that it's Nazi
good,
type.
Good versus evil kind of election. Yeah. I've never heard of those before.
Yeah. And if he'd been elected, this is the quote. Yeah, we're lucky. If Deutscher had gotten in, we'd have the worst kind of dictatorship. There's an anti-everything man for you, a militarist, anti-Christ, anti-human, anti-intellectual. People called us up, joking but not joking, said if Deutscher became president, they wanted to go live in 1492. Of course, it's not our business to conduct escapes with a capital E. Keith is president now. So much great foreshadowing that's set up of the dangers of not following instructions, not straying off the path, not making some mistake that could change the future. And of course, as I guess close readers, we know that maybe things aren't going to go as planned here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, they guarantee nothing. They guarantee nothing.
All of those little hints. So these guys get to the distant millions and millions of years ago past. They're on this path that they cannot get off of. They have their weapons. The timing has to be perfect. They say, okay, this beast is coming at you. It's going to be coming from this direction and this many seconds, and get ready. And here are the kill shots. Take these kill shots. When this dinosaur, what is it, a T-Rex, comes, and the description of this beast is amazing, comes charging them, our anti-hero, the main character, panics. And of course, what does he do? He runs away and gets discombobulated and falls off the path. And spoiler alert, when they get back, things have changed.
Right.
This is the first time I got the end where it was the sound of thunder. Now, I had worked that into something else in my head, the sound of thunder, but now I know what that really means.
You're thinking of the gunshot.
Sound of thunder, yeah.
So many things to discuss here.
Let's start with the rules. This is the first time travel story that really set up rules for time travel. In a lot of the stories about time travel that I've read since, there are rules. There are always rules. And they're not all the same as, you know, the original Sound of Thunder. Those rules can be broken. Some of them say, oh, you can't meet yourself. That was in Sound of Thunder. Paradoxes. You can't change the past. Well, you can change the past. You can't share your time travel experiences, because if you tell somebody else, they might change something, and the next person might change something. So you can't even say you're a time traveler, because that will mess it up. And then you've got messages you can send from the past to the future. You can't really do that in reverse, but if you're in the past, you can send messages. You can write something on paper and hide it behind a brick, and then somebody from the present can come along, and if they know where to look, they can read that message. You've got time travel like Brigadoon time travel. Once in 100 years, the little village appears in the glen, and then it disappears again. That's more magical. That's not a machine. That's not in your mind. It's magical. What else do I have here? Yeah.
All that works to make this a sort of, I think Bradbury is often doing that, a sort of cautionary tale. So many of his stories seem to be cautionary, right? Fahrenheit 451, full of cautionary moments, warnings. One of his gifts in terms of his ideas is the sci-fi thing of extrapolation, taking an idea and saying, what if, and just taking it quite far. And here it's, what if we could go back in time? What if people could take tours? What would that mean? Part of the rules are about a part morality, but part trying to control something. Here they're trying to control the nature of time and the natural world. And they set up these rules and they say, stay on this path. They think that they have control. And of course, the great irony is that they don't. We don't really have control. We like to think that. We try.
I got the same feeling from the character in Jurassic Park that was backing the chaos theory. And he was taking the tour with him, and he's saying, oh, this is great. This is wonderful. You guys got to watch out. Did you think about this? Don't worry about that. When we've got it all under control. And the guy's just rolling his eyes going, okay. And then you hear the thump of the T-Rexes catching up to him in the little Jeeps.
Yeah, beautiful scene. Yeah,
read the book, seen the movie so many times. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah, Jurassic Park. A lot of similarities in terms of the feeling and the kind of the premise, the feeling.
It's a form of time travel, right? You take DNA that's frozen in time by the amber and then reactivated into the present.
Right.
That's
interesting. Yeah, bringing the past forward. Yeah. It's going back to the future.
Oh, no. See, my head just hurts when we talk about this stuff. And then let's talk about time travel and free will, is it changeable?
I think that relates to these rules in some way. Yeah, free will, how much control do you have? It's a false sense of agency here. You can mess with things and make choices, but ultimately, it's too overwhelming, right, in some way. The point here being these little choices, purposeful or accidental, right?
Yeah.
Have such accidental, a ripple effect.
For sure.
Just the path emphasis to me just had me thinking about related, just Little Red Riding or some sort of tale.
Stay on the path, little girl. That wolf will get you. And so that something that we all should do is stay on the path and be afraid all the time, or shall we look behind door number three?
I've always felt, really didn't like that idea. It's a, Victorian ideal of little girls should be this way. Don't you stay on the path if you want to be a good girl and be accepted and be successful, and don't you dare, right, stray from the path. Which I don't like that idea myself, but I guess if I were going back in time to hunt dinosaurs, I feel like I should stay on the path, right?
Buddhism with the middle path, there are all these journeys and pathways that we can negotiate.
This is the way. So we get this character, Eccles, who he's gone back. He's obviously super wealthy. He's here on a tour. He's paid a lot of money. He's done some hunting. They've arrived in the past, and this part of building the tension, the foreshadowing, the warnings of what might take place. I like that this fog is set up. In Little Red Riding Hood, you get this, she goes off into the woods, right? So she leaves sort of the village, this safe place. And this is typical of some hero's journey aspects to this, where they're going out into the woods, into the wild, in this case, the jungle. And then it says a fog had enveloped the machine, right? The fog that enveloped the machine blows away, and they're in old times. So they go over this mood of kind of mystery, and now they're in this jungle. This is a place of experience where there's less control and wild things happen. Usually something dangerous happens, right?
That changes. Yeah, I was thinking very dangerous. Life-threatening, dangerous.
Yeah, and Travis, his leader, is talking. He's saying Christ isn't born yet. Moses hasn't gone into the mountains. None of this history has happened, right? The pyramids are still in the earth. I love that. So Bradbury is just such a great writer, right? They're still in the earth, the imagery there. Alexander, Caesar, Napoleon, Hitler, none of them have existed. Of course, they're all tyrant leaders, right? This is our reminder that it's the jungle of 60,000,255 years before President Keith. So it's before Keith.
Third hint.
Yeah. And so he indicates this metal path, and maybe that's one of our, I don't know how many sci-fi devices we'll get into. But there's a time machine, obviously. Is the path laid by Time Safari for your use, right? He gets into all those rules and things. And then Eccles is asking questions. What if we did stray? What might happen? Destroying one little thing could destroy everything. Kill one mouse, and it would be all the families. And all the families of that one mouse with the stamp of your foot, you annihilate first one, then a dozen, then a thousand, a billion possible mice. That goes, so what? They're dead. What does it matter? I mean, I don't know. This is a long paragraph here, but he gets into what about the foxes that will need that? And the foxes are gone. The lion could starve. And then but it goes on and on. And he gets into the stomp of your foot. On one mouse could start an earthquake, the effects of which could shake the earth and destinies down through time to their very foundations. With the death of that one caveman, a billion others yet unborn or throttled in the womb, perhaps Rome never rises on its seven hills. Perhaps Europe is forever a dark forest and only Asia waxes healthy and teeming. Step on a mouse and you crush the pyramids. Step on a mouse and you leave your print. Like a grand canyon across eternity. Queen Elizabeth might never be born. Washington might not cross the Delaware. there might never be a United States at all. So be careful. Stay on the path. Never step off.
See, that's where I thought the sound of thunder came from. That passage there is like ominous and rumbling like thunder.
Absolutely. I think that is the sound of thunder. Many sounds of thunder.
You get this psychological idea of what it could be, and then you get the very immediate danger and action that the T-Rex brings to the story. The juxtaposition and foreshadowing and descriptions in this story are quite wonderful.
Yeah, beautiful writing, beautiful short story. That sets up this moment with the T-Rex. They arrive, they leave the machine, but shortly thereafter, they hear everyone stops. Oh, Eccles is getting nervous here, right? He says he's shaking like a kid. And Travis raises his hand in the midst. There he is. There's his royal majesty now. And I love Bradbury's choice of language, right? It's his royal majesty, right? And of course, we're dealing with a Tyrannosaurus Rex,
which
is the tyrant king.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Rex
yes.
king, Tyrannosaurus. And so it's this tyrant, right? Oh, right there, it says silence and a sound of thunder, right? We hear this kind of, the roar, the rumble, right? So we get another sound of thunder. And so this tyrant is like the sound of thunder, right? And it came on great, this is a quote here, Bradbury. I just love his writing. It came on great, oiled, resilient, striding legs. It towered 30 feet above half of the trees, a great evil god, folding its delicate watchmaker's claws close to its oily reptilian chest. Each lower leg was a piston, 1,000 pounds of white bone sunk in thick ropes of muscle, sheathed over a gleam of pebble skin like the mail of a terrible warrior. Each thigh was a ton of meat, ivory, and steel mesh. And from the great breathing cage of the upper body, those two delicate arms dangled out front, arms with hands which might pick up and examine men like toys, while the snake neck coiled, and the head itself, a ton of sculptured stone, lifted easily upon the sky, its mouth gaped, exposing a fence of teeth like daggers. Its eyes rolled ostrich eggs, empty of all expression save hunger. It closed its mouth in a death grin. It ran, its pelvic bones crushing aside trees and bushes, its taloned feet clawing damp earth, leaving prints 6 inches deep wherever it settled its weight. It ran with a gliding ballet step, far too poised and balanced for its 10 tons. It moved into a sunlit area warily, its beautifully reptilian hands feeling the air. So cool.
Oh, I love that. I love
Eccles
that.
Eccles is like, it could reach up and grab them. And they're like, shut up, nightmare. Back to the machine. Eccles, they're telling them, go back, walk back to the machine. It'll get you, which is a mistake. They should have kept him there. Be like, sit down on the path and shut up. Stay quiet.
Oh, you're going to fix this, huh?
That was a mistake, right? Sending that guy back alone. Later describes it as the tyrant lizard. And they send him back to hide in the machine. So real man versus kind of nature moment here, right? They're fighting this tyrant lizard. But I love this. I didn't really think of this till this reading, but here we've got this parallel, right? Where you've got this tyrant of the past, this tyrant lizard, and there's a fear of the tyrant in the future.
Oh, nice.
Deutscher.
I didn't see that. Okay. Yeah.
Ironically, yeah, he runs away from the tyrant of the past. And by running away from the tyrant in the past, he creates the tyrant in the future.
Oh, okay.
Can't be accidental that Bradbury's chosen a T-Rex. It makes sense. We grew up thinking it was the most ferocious, right? It can't be accidental. You've got the number of references about this sort of royalty or this king-like figure, tyrant. And runs away from it. We've got all these tyrants mentioned throughout. He seals it. He makes his choice. The irony of not killing one. We could extrapolate from that we have to face tyrants. Maybe that's the sort of lesson, is one takeaway is we face, deal with our own tyrants in a way if we want to maintain democracy and a certain way of life. As a, I mean, this is a very American-centered sort of story, at least with all the references, but Bradbury writing it in the 50s, this under this, the same moment he's writing Fahrenheit 451. These stories are created at the same time, which is really cool. And I love all the references to fire and stuff that kind of, that appear in both. Appear of fear of Cold War. And
one little thing can explode the world into just a tater tot. Ducking cover.
Yeah, a real moment of, if we're not careful, we could destroy democracy and destroy life as we know it.
The Cuban crisis.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, comes to that today, right? We are in 2023. We're recording this on August 18th. Maybe we dance around politics a bit, and I don't know. I've
done such a good job of doing that. I think we have similar backgrounds or thinking about politics and democracy and all of that. But our media consuming is much different. I consume it all, and you try to stay away from it. I think that's pretty interesting.
I don't know. I wouldn't say that I stay away from it. I would say I try to
moderate.
I tend to, I don't own a TV, right? So I don't.
Oh, you know, I don't. Okay. But you have a laptop and you can get Hulu on your laptop too.
I guess maybe that sounds, I know, I just mean by not owning the TV. And I'm not saying that we won't get one at some point, but I haven't had a TV ever as an adult. I've never had a TV.
Wow.
Yeah, never owned one.
How about a landline, a telephone landline?
Or a landline. I've never had one.
Never had a landline.
Trying to think if I did early. There might have been one. I mean, it was never, I can't even remember if there was one. Maybe when I lived in a dormitory for a few months.
Okay, that does not count.
Might have been a landline there.
No.
Yeah, absolutely. I was trying to say it's a little bit less mainstream, but I listen to podcasts that are pretty mainstream as well. New York Times stuff and NPR and things like that. So to get back to this, a moment here where it's like, depending on some choices, if we're not careful, there can be a ripple effect and we end up with very different, say, political leaders. And every election, I guess, has been like that. But certainly in the U.S., the more recent elections for us have felt more like choices between extreme differences.
Yes. Black and white, good and evil. All of the lines seem to be not blurring as much as they used to. For years in Michigan, I voted for this Republican state senator because she was amazing. She did her job the way that I felt she should be doing it. But I don't think that happens very much anymore. Don't split your. You have to vote this way or people would take advantage of that and have kind of attitude. I see the choices you're talking about.
Yeah, I was just struck by words like, I'd read it earlier. Where was it? Anti-human, anti-intellectual. I think there's some fear of that. I guess, In the U.S., obviously, we're looking at Republicans and Democrats. Right? It's going to be one or the other that always ends up elected. And each side would probably argue, and in their own media echo chambers, suggest that the other side is anti-intellectual, right? Or the other side is maybe anti-human in some way.
I have never seen so much projection. They are telling you lies. And don't listen to them. It's fake news. I've never seen that widespread as I've seen it in the last few years. It's just, what? How can you say that? Because if I say it enough times, maybe people will think it's true. I think that's how that came about. It's very dark and ugly.
This reminds me of Fahrenheit 451. There's moments where maybe the difference
Excuse me, that was season one in Life, Death, Sci-Fi. You can find our
podcast of Fahrenheit 451.
We will link to it in the show notes.
Yeah.
And Beatty, this character, is discussing what happened that led to this certain future. And in that case, the people ended up choosing that. They wanted this society of mindless pleasure seeking and anti kind of intellectualism. They end up there because of the forms of censorship that the people chose. They end up in an authoritarian world that the people elect. They choose that. They vote for it, which is scary, right? I think with certain media echo chambers, maybe you end up in a place where if the media is not giving us our vegetables and it's just feeding us the sugar that tastes good because it already feeds our biases and it's, oh yeah.
And it's beautiful and delicious. And, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not truthful. Sometimes the truth is, I don't know, some mushy peas or whatever.
Yeah.
Bitter. Some unseasoned mushy peas, overcooked peas. I don't know. That's my worst. I like broccoli too much to get into that. Although overcooked, any kind of overcooked vegetables are pretty good.
You could make them frozen peas too.
We need some of that and we need to get that in order to be informed in a way that helps us make choices that are in our own best interest, whether we know it or not. I don't know, my spiel. We're not going to solve that problem today. I think that's some of the things I love about Bradbury. Like, you don't feel like it's a little bit pedantic or didactic with Beatty in some of those moments in Fahrenheit. I guess I don't mind it there. It's just, that's a book, right? So you just get a few moments here or there.
Yeah.
And here, we're not being lectured in this short story at all. It's just, he's just throwing it out there. And instead, we're on this really intense expedition to shoot a dinosaur. It's exciting. It's full of beautiful writing. And yet it has this wonderful sci-fi extrapolation of what if.
I think a lot of people, when he first had this out, probably read it for the adventure part of it.
Oh.
Go into the past and shoot the dinosaur. What's that going to be like? But then he throws in this little butterfly effect. And that's the thing, the butterfly effect that just makes this story amazing.
Here's the spoiler. They kill the dinosaur as they're meant to. What's his name? I just said it. Who's the leader on the...
Oh, Travis?
He makes Eccles run away. He makes Eccles like dig out the bullets and go back. Which is a bit gory. And I forgot about that part. And maybe... I guess they have to take the bullets out. A bit unnecessary that he's making him do, but he's angry because he feels like Eccles really jeopardized the future by cowering out of this moment. Of course, we finally get back to the future, and things are different. And Travis realizes something's gone wrong here, and they find, of course, this butterfly on Eccles' boot.
Oh.
Stepped off the path, and in his anger, ends with him really executing Eccles, shooting him for his misstep, no pun intended. Yeah.
Oh, misstep.
Pun intended.
Was that necessary or not? Yeah, I could see where Travis got so PO'd that he did that, but it's not going to change anything. He is where he is. And I suppose in some fan fiction, you could write it in that Travis jumps back into the time machine. And goes back 15 minutes before Les Perrins steps off the path and grabs him back into the time machine just in time.
That's something that I wanted to bring up. There's a moment early on, because you're talking about, couldn't they just simply fix this? Can't they just go back into time? And that was my thought, and change it. Would it be that big a deal? Just get back in the time machine, go back, and make sure that he doesn't step on the butterfly.
Yeah.
Which of course that's possible, right? The only way it wouldn't be possible is if somehow in the future, there was somebody knowingly waiting for them in the future to get back and to make sure that they aren't able, like that somebody would, because they're the only people that haven't experienced everything that led up to that new future. So
right.
They're the only ones arriving back. And so if somehow the people waiting for them to come back were to know what had happened. And I'm not sure if they could know necessarily. They wouldn't necessarily know. So you see where I'm going? Then they could get back on the next trip. Travis and L'Espérance, this French name that means hope, ironical.
Sense.
I don't know. Yeah,
Esperanza, Les Esperanza.
Which is, are those accidents? I don't know. I mean, we're talking about Ray Bradbury, who named this Fahrenheit 451 character after a pencil. So I don't know Montag, but it does mean. Like,
I didn't know that.
I think it also means like everyman or something. But he he says, I think in an interview that he saw it on a box of pencil. Anyway, could they go back in time? And I actually watched the movie 2005 movie version yesterday.
Oh, I wanted to do that.
I'm wondering if I should tell you anything because I think I won't, because I found it really quite fun. I think I enjoyed it. It's amazing how things have changed. It's fun to watch how terrible the special effects are.
Kind of like
2005.
An old Star Trek movie.
Anyway, the way it deals with things, it attempts to deal with some of the issues of this short story, interesting way.
Okay.
And it breaks some of the things that Bradbury sets up as well.
I think now, after reading so many time travel stories, talking to you about time travel, I think you're just making this stuff up as it goes along. You could take a notebook with you with the important facts, and then when you get back, you could compare those kind of things. But then, I don't know, you could keep going back to the past to try to fix the things that you broke the first time, and then the second time, and then the third time, and then where are you now?
Right.
When you're fixing it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what so many TV shows and sci-fi TV shows and movies and things often, maybe not quite movies as much, but a lot of shows, they end up doing that where it's just going back and it's just impossible.
Your wife and kid was killed in a car crash and now you want to go back and change the past because of that. And then the big lesson of those stories usually is that no, you can't change the past. But recently There was a movie called Dev, D-E-V,
was that a series?
Computer. Yes.
No, series.
Limited series, yeah. That supercomputer was able to build a world where they could live. And then you get into this far and it's really a slippery slope into different dimensions, different timelines, and how that affects your idea of what time travel is. And then pixels, and then you throw in the Matrix. There are serious scientific theories that seem to think that we live in a kind of a Matrix. And then if we do that, if we live in kind of a matrix, how can we affect time travel and what our minds think about consciousness? What is that? And is time travel all in our consciousness? What is reality? Slippery slope. My head hurts. Kind of
right.
Thing.
And that's what I want to come back to with Bradbury here. So how does Bradbury deal with it? This is when they start talking about a paradox. So early on, okay, they talk about the dinosaurs are marked red paint, studying them, and then Eccles says, but if you come back this morning in time, said Eccles eagerly, you must have bumped into us on our safari.
Oh, yeah.
So are they going back and shooting the same dinosaur in each trip or a different one that morning? How did it turn out? Was it successful? Did all of us get through a lot? Right. Ooh, do they all
get
alive? Well, you do get through alive and then you get killed, but comes later. And then Travis and L'Espérance gave each other a look. That'd be a paradox, said the latter. Time doesn't permit that sort of mess a man meeting. Right. I like that turn of phrase, right? Mess a man meeting. But I was trying to think of the phrase earlier. I think it's the grandfather paradox is the term for it, right? Where you can go back and meet yourself.
Yeah.
And so when such occasions threaten, Bradbury writes, time steps aside. Like an airplane hitting an air pocket. You felt the machine jump just before we stopped? That was us passing ourselves on the way back to the future. We saw nothing. There's no way of telling if this expedition was a success, if we got our monster, or whether all of us, meaning you, Mr. Eccles, got out alive. All right. What? And this is where that chaos theory or whatever, and I was kind of thinking there's some sort of magic. And Bradbury's never been really a hard science guy, right? Very soft science fiction, which I enjoy.
But it's almost there. His science is there. But yes, I think it is sprinkled with a little magic and that suspended belief.
A little bit of fantasy there. So he's saying you went back to the exact same place in time. When you're there, how could you not see yourself? Of course you would see yourself. Or is this like the multiverse? Are we back in the
Who's multiverse? Making the rules? Who's making the rules on this? And whose fingers are on the typewriter when the story is being written? I think.
Or is it automatically a multiverse?
See, could be. Could be. Who knows?
Bradbury makes up these waves or these ripples. That's an interesting idea that you can't meet yourself, but it certainly removes the complexity of doing that. It also means they can't go back and stop themselves. Right?
Oh, so the story moves on. Isaac Asimov wrote a time travel story. He doesn't say time police, I don't think. But it's this team of people who go up and down the timeline fixing it.
Hmm.
And that's their job. And they're in a bubble of no time. And pretty interesting.
Did they make a series out of that?
Maybe.
I'm trying to think of something.
Quite a few stories. Like,
yeah. I think I was watching
out the time police.
A series like that. It wasn't like Travelers was sort of one. I'm thinking of a different one.
Travelers, yeah, that's right. Yeah, but that got cut off in the giggly weeds when they on season 5 or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if I that far.
Okay, so you have read a few time travel stories, investigated, thought about this time travel idea. Are you more in favor of it now or less in favor of it? How are you on that continuum?
Oh, whether or not people should time travel?
Or whether it's possible.
Whether it's possible. What?
Could be possible. Probably is possible. No, it's not possible at all. Remember, time travel comes in many different forms, like Jurassic Park. They just
reanimated
a worm that was, 40,000 years old?
Yeah, it started having little baby worms right away.
There's no problem.
Well, there might be, right? Butterfly effect.
Yeah, for sure.
We don't know. A few thousand years down the road, it all started with that little reanimated worm.
So what do you think?
I don't know. It seems.
Oh.
I guess in other forms of time travel, like the idea that somebody could get in some sort of a machine and travel back, it's hard to imagine that would ever be true. This sort of dev idea or something where.
It's a machine.
Yeah.
It's machine driven.
Are we more machine like? And I think we realize, I think there's probably so much that we still don't understand about the human body and. We all a little more battery-like than I think we've realized over all this time. I mean, absorbing. I think there's probably more to do with light and water and all that than we quite understand yet. Are we all part of some matrix? Maybe.
One of the things I've been watching is about the eighth dimension. That is definitely in the whole pixelated matrix philosophy.
Eighth dimension.
Really believable. Yeah. They go through the two-dimensional, three-dimensional. How do we get to the fourth dimension?
Where was this?
It's a team that is developing this, and they have put out a couple of videos on it. So I was going to send it along to you, but it gets into some stuff that isn't especially time travel either. But the way they talk about dimensions is pretty interesting because you take this 3D model of like a cube and then you look at the shadow of the 3D model on a surface. And that could be how the fourth dimension is to us, that they explain it way better.
Yeah, send it to me. I'm interested in anything like that.
So let's see if I've got this straight. You don't think we can build a machine necessarily to time travel, jump in it, like H.G. Wells, but time travel could possibly be something that could happen.
Yeah, I guess I'm at the risk of sounding like a madman, and I'm not smart enough to explain any of it, but I like to think most anything's possible. Maybe that's the interest in sci-fi in some ways. I think so many extrapolations could be possible. And so maybe if I could believe that we're all in some sort of matrix, why wouldn't I believe that someone could travel through time within that matrix?
The present and the past and the future are all the same. And it's right here where
no one can really explain how things began. And I think without an explanation of that, anything seems possible, right? And that's just where I can't wrap my mind around it. I'm not capable of understanding how there cannot be a beginning or end to things. But as a human being, everything that I know seems to have some sort of beginning and end.
So you don't believe in infinity?
Well, it's not that I don't believe in it. I just can't understand it.
Yeah.
How can something not have a beginning? That's not a thing.
Or an end.
Or an
infinity
end.
Or an end.
I think when you keep going with that idea, of course there cannot be exactly a beginning or an end, right? There has to be something. There has to be something before the beginning, and therefore it has to be some sort of infinity.
So what was before that? What was before
something,
that?
Right? There has to be
something, right? Is a thing.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Or space is a thing. Empty space is a thing.
That blows my mind. And so I don't know, what do you do with that? To me, because there are things that are explicable and that I cannot wrap my head around, therefore I feel like anything's possible, and time travel could be possible. Sure.
Oh, okay. You brought it back. Nice. Yeah. Nice.
Well, anything's possible.
Okay. At the beginning of this podcast, you said you had a kind of a surprise for the next thing.
I thought I might suggest another short story, and it's by an author we've read a number of times, and it also deals with paradoxes in a different kind of way. That story is also written not long after Bradbury's, published in 1958. It is All You Zombies by Robert A. Heinlein.
I've heard of that. And I heard that's one of his more popular books, maybe.
Short story, short fiction.
Short story.
So it's time travel.
All right. So is it time for our end of the podcast picnic?
Travis, who's just killed a man for destroying the world as he knew it? Has he left work and wandered? Is he even able to get a drink? Is he emerging into a 1984 type situation?
I've got that problem solved. He left the bar back on the path that he put out for this time travel trip. And so he's just going to go back there and hang out on the path, enjoying the sights and sounds of the jungle.
Oh, he's going back in time?
Yeah.
So maybe he's having some, I don't know, is it a rum-like drink? I'm wondering what he's drinking. I was going to say maybe he's having some Victory Gin in a 1984 style authoritarian regime, and he's going to go drown his sorrows and be careful not to talk about the way things used to be, lest he be thrown in the ministry of love.
Wait a minute. I'm way ahead of you here. Okay, so he's hanging out back on his platform, sipping his gin. And when he returns, he has the ability now to return to any time he wants.
Hmm. But here's the problem. Wherever he returns to, it's changed because of that first time he went back.
Because of the first time he went back.
Yeah, because you're talking about Travis, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but isn't he going back after after the butterfly effect has taken...
Right, so he's going back.
So when he goes back, unless he goes back, and according to Bradbury, go back and stop himself, right? Because he can't cross paths. So if he goes back, and then when he returns toward the future, it's not, none of those futures are the futures. It's all changed because of that butterfly that was stepped on. So he might say to himself, I'm just going to return to the roaring 20s and have a cocktail. But those roaring 20s might not be those roaring 20s because of the butterfly that was stepped on.
Oh, I see. So he's, okay. All right. Yeah. So the butterfly goes through, okay.
Yeah. Mm. I think he's probably like in his despair, gone back and just completely wandered off the path. He's trudging around, stepping on all kinds of insects and butterflies until he eventually finds himself in some cave where some rotting fruit has fallen into a puddle. He's drinking this and having some fermented ayahuasca-like experience where he's dreamed a whole new dream of where things could be. He's realized none of it matters at all. Because he's just one with all of everything around him. Yeah.
And there's your happy ending.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And now he's really changed. It's a completely different future that he's created anyway in his trudging around.
Where it's raining donuts.
Exactly. I actually didn't rewatch that, but we should definitely link to, if it's out there, I guess. I've got an old copy of, I can't remember what episode it was, but The Simpsons.
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
House of Horror parody of Sound of Thunder. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it was.
I'll see you in the future at the Space Ball. Yeah. Let's hope they're not serving Victory Gin.
That's right. And yeah. And I like the book we picked, or the story we picked to go along with the zombies.
Yeah, all you zombies, that should be fun. We keep ending up with our buddy Heinlein there. He is a legend.
I know. I see things like that happening, the old ideas that are just left there, and how it's once in a while get slammed up against how we think now. And it makes a noise.
Cognitive dissonance.
When that happens, and I hope this new Heinlein story has less that. Because it's a short story, it probably doesn't have as much.
Yeah, we're referencing an earlier episode in which we discussed Stranger in a Strange Land. Yeah. And I think that's why I thought we had Heinlein in every season. But that's not right. He wasn't in our Mars season. I think I thought so because he was a question mark or a transition, right? Because that's a character who grew up on Mars and returns to Earth. And so there is a Mars connection there. But actually, we just talked about him in our first season, right?
We talked about him in our first season. And then when we were talking about other Mars books, we came back to him a couple of times and talked about that.
But we didn't actually meet. Yeah.
Okay. But authors do follow us with our ideas here, or we're following them. Yeah, it's interesting. We got to say something about the Spaceman's Ball, because we always do.
Yeah, I'll see you in the future at the Spaceman's Ball.
I don't know. For me, it might be in the past.
Good to go.
A past Spaceman's Ball? I don't know. How are we going to meet? Where in the present?
I don't know. I'm going to go back to the future. I like that phrase here. That appears, right? Back to the future. The Sound of Thunder. They go back to the future.
Back to the future, yeah.
I think that phrase is in there.
I think it is, too.
I'll go back to the future and see you at Spaceman's Ball. Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Eric, nice to chat,
Chris,
as always.
And take care. See you later.
All right. Future.
What's that?